Hey, everybody out there in Radio Land, welcome to the KM&R Video Games Special Talk Show. My name is DJ Wolverine, and I'm here in a packed studio room with four other DJs. Let's go around and introduce ourselves. Who are you, and what do you do?
All right, I'm Dirty Harry. Got a show normally from 3 to 7 p.m. on Fridays. Favorite game is Contra for the NES.
When did you get into video games?
When I was like 3 or 4 years old, I want to say is my earliest memory of playing Super C.
In the genres of your expertise?
I guess side-scrolling classic games.
And J-pop?
Not quite, no.
Bad 80s movies?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Cool. The Wizard. Oh, yeah, The Wizard. All right, I'm Action Jackson. My show is The Impossible Chrononauts. It's on every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. Right now, I'm really digging on Dwarf Fortress. That takes up a considerable chunk of my time.
Oh, that's good, because I'm going to want to ask you about Dwarf Fortress later.
Okay. And let's see. My first experience with video games is... Oh, gosh. I think it was when my brother from my dad's first marriage brought over his NES for the first time, and they were playing Super Mario Brothers. How legit is that?
Very.
They tricked me, though. They, like... pretended like the second controller was plugged in, so I was just like watching Super Mario Brothers and banging on the controller. Nothing I did actually affected reality.
That's wrong. Although I do it all the time with little kids.
I'm DJ Cold Steel, and I'm not going to shamelessly plug my show, but I am an amazing DJ here at KM&R. I'm also the trainee director. So, yes, power is mine.
Anyway, so you like the RPGs?
I am a fan of a many, many genre, and it's hard to boil it down. But currently, most of my time is taken up by first-person shooters, Call of Duty. I do play a good deal of MMOs, but I respect and enjoy the classical Japanese RPG. I also am a fan of dungeon crawlers. I love Diablo. Torchlight's pretty decent. But then, you know, action games, Legend of Zelda, that kind of thing.
Okay, and we're back to me. Again, Dr. Trollinger, I am the production room director, so if everything sounds terrible, you can blame it on me. And I play a lot of, like, Steam has pretty much just taken over my life, play a lot of little indie games off of that. If something is going to, like, sell me their game for $2, I'm probably going to buy it and play it for a little bit. Let's see. My favorite game of all time would have to be Ocarina of Time. I played that game like 20 times in middle school. So, and I would play it again. I've never beaten Master Quest, though. So, anyway. So, most of my current gaming is been like Dungeon Defenders and Terraria and stuff like that. I'm sort of a budding hobbyist developer myself. So, I'm just working on a couple little projects that have been inspired by those little indie games. Anyway, that's all I got for you.
I myself am a lifelong gamer. I play anything and everything. I'm very retro, I guess you could say, a Renaissance gamer. I like the older stuff mostly better than the current stuff. Right now I'm playing through Arkham Asylum, Xbox 360. And it's really hard to avoid spoilers for that online.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Really hard. Yeah. But it's taking up my time, and hopefully I'll move on to Arkham City after I get through it. I too am a budding game developer. My first attempt at college was Digipen on the Nintendo campus back about a decade ago, and I was actually friends with the Portal team people. But that didn't work out so much because calculus really... really melted my brain. So now I'm an English major, of all things.
Maybe you can go back in time and fix the Double Dragon 3 typo.
So the plot of your game...
It has to be there.
The president's daughter has been kidnapped by the evil guys. You gotta go beat them, right? That's the plot.
Because you're a bad dude.
Yeah.
It's the hero's quest.
Yes, yes.
Or the hero's journey. That's
Joseph Campbell. Actually, the English teacher at Digipen was very much into Joseph Campbell's Journey of the Hero.
Yeah.
And then when he mentioned that Star Wars was based on that, that's when we all perked up. We're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
But now they say that, like, everything is based on that hero's journey. And, like, anytime someone starts to bring up the argument that it's like basically the same story, it always comes down to everything's the same story because it's all the hero's journey.
That's archetypes and stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Boiling it down, it's basically there are no original stories. Everything has been done in some form or another over the centuries.
Oh, yeah.
Going all the way back to classical antiquity in the Greek and Roman dramatists.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with that concept.
Yeah.
It was all based off of like Odyssey or something.
Like from the most basic myths of how the sun ruled the earth.
And, I gotcha. And
why storms came and destroyed your crops kind of thing. And Joseph Campbell actually took the mythology of lots of different cultures and analyzed them and cross-referenced them and came up with this comparative mythology that basically said they were all telling the exact same stories, just with different details and different names and places changed. And like the deluge, the biblical flood, that same story is in pretty much every culture across the world, which is pretty cool. But all your Final Fantasy plots, they either came from Shakespeare or the Bible or classical antiquity, probably, in some form or another, is the theory.
Which story from the Bible or classic antiquity starts with a hero waking up, being yelled at by his mom, and then he's a righteous hero whose dad is missing, and then he has to go and fight the odds and save the world?
That would be Oedipus.
Okay.
What about one where a boy wakes up on his 15th birthday and his mom says, go visit your grandpa to get miniature monsters?
I thought he was talking about at first.
Yeah, I totally thought he was going to go
Hercules.
Hercules? Really? What? His story of Pokemon is derivative of Hercules.
I don't know.
If you think about it, I mean, Hercules was a young boy who was forced to leave his home to, like, prove his worth. Mm-hmm. And
he didn't know how powerful he was.
Yeah, he had to go around and complete various tasks to get rewards, like, you know, the stables or getting...
He just wanted to prove that he's worthy of his father's love.
Yeah. That's all it's all about.
You got it. Exactly.
So what is Porygon representative of?
I'm not familiar with that.
That's the digital Pokemon, the one that was created inside the computer.
Oh.
He also induces seizures in a special Japanese-only episode.
Some people argue that the comparative myth theory is not right, because with the advent of digital technology, we're going to be making new stories.
Maybe.
That have no analog in previous times at all.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of like how many times you have to derive a story before you get back to the core. I mean, you're eventually going to get back to that, you know, core piece of, you know, conflict resolution type. What is it? Rising tension.
Rising action, tension, climax, resolution.
Your resolution. At some point, you're going to get back to that, and then the hero's journey is just built on top of that. I know all the words, the Englishes.
Yeah.
What are we? We've been talking about a story here for like 7 years. Let's go back to Dwarf Fortress. I want to hear about this game.
That's what we do.
Okay.
Because I've installed it, I think, 2 or 3 times, and then you just kind of look at it and you're just mystified. Because you're like reading The Matrix and you haven't learned yet. And so what goes on there? I've heard so many like ridiculous stories about the things that are happening to these dwarves, and I cannot figure it out.
Should we go into what we're currently playing now? We'll start with you.
No, let's talk about
Dwarf Fortress. Okay, well, one of the like most popular base memes for Dwarf Fortress is that scene from The Matrix where Cypher is looking at the screens and Neo asks him if he can tell what's going on, and Cypher says, "I don't even see the characters. I just see redhead, blonde, brunette, and so on and so forth." Well, that's pretty much what Dwarf Fortress is like. However, I'm not that hardcore about Dwarf Fortress. There are graphic sets that you can install that make
this.
It look very nice. They all come in a... you can actually download this package called the Lazy Noob Pack, which, while insulting, kind of, it does provide a nice little interface that lets you tweak some of the more common options and select the graphic set, as well as turn off annoying things like aquifers and such. Let me actually backtrack a little bit. The whole premise of the game is that you're a group of dwarves and you're trying to stake out like a colony of your civilization in this procedurally generated world. So it's like Minecraft, except it predates Minecraft. The first release of Dwarf Fortress was 2006, I think. And so then every season you get migrants that come into your fortress and you have to manage them. The whole game is really not about winning so much as it about as it is about preventing losing for as long as you possibly can. The game is not really meant to be won. There's no win condition in the game. And so it's a lot of kind of a cross between SimCity and Minecraft with a lot of micromanagement involved.
Well, how are you actually going about, like, controlling things? What are you... Is it sort of like an RTS where you're, like, selecting things and telling them to go places? Or is it, like, more like Majesty where it's like, okay, well, I just put a bounty on this guy's head. Hopefully some of my warriors will go kill him.
Sure. You actually act as a kind of, like, grand overseer. Each of the dwarves, each unit of the population in your fortress is actually an autonomous unit that makes his own decisions about what he wants to do at any given time based on a... like a hard-coded priority system, but you can specify things that you want done, and eventually, if a dwarf has the right skills assigned to it, it'll get done. So you have a dwarf that has his mining skill enabled, you designate the tiles that you want to have dug out, and he'll eventually get around to go digging it out. And okay. He tends to do this as stupidly as possible.
So it's like Lemmings.
Yeah, it's like Lemmings, except... I mean, you can get a lot more grandiose with it and cause a lot of problems
so
for yourself.
What's the big appeal? Why is it getting big?
Actually, the big thing about Dwarf Fortress is that everything in the game is procedurally generated. They have a sort of a set of core mechanics that it wants to fulfill, like the fact that there are demons and they all live down near the Magma Sea, and the dwarves have this predefined set of skills, and they have the largely predefined set of creatures, but beyond that, it generates this world, and it actually starts, before you start playing, you actually simulate the world for a period of time that you specify, and during that time, all these creatures interact for a while, and they set up civilizations, and kill each other, and things like that, so you start playing in a world that has a history, and no two worlds have the same, exact same starting history, and so from there, you get to see how the world changes as you play it, and there are also creatures in the game that are completely randomly generated, and they are kind of ridiculous, and so it's really all about how you end up losing and how you prevent yourself from losing until that time. Some of the more common ways include the Catsplosion, which is
sounds like something out of Worms Armageddon.
It's actually a very interesting problem, because you can bring cats, and cats are very handy to have in your fortress
because
they kill vermin.
Yeah.
But the thing is about cats is that
apparently.
It's not so much that, they're extremely horny.
Oh.
And they are also apparently slightly psychic, because normally a dwarf would take a pet into our fortress, but instead, cats take dwarves as pets, and I don't know if this matters, and if you kill a dwarf's pet, even if it's the reverse relationship, the dwarf gets very sad. So what happens is cats attach themselves to your dwarf so you can't kill them, and then they breed with each other quite profusely until you have hundreds of cats. And then the game can't path all the cats at the same time. So eventually what happens is the game becomes unplayable because you have so many cats trying to move around your map.
Wow.
And then there's also people who have modded the games so that cats have an internal temperature of like thousands of degrees, which causes them to explode instantly, which is an entirely different and also humorous version of Catsplosion.
So there are many ways to die other than just literally dying. Apparently. The game just kills itself somehow.
Yeah. There's FPS death, there's being conquered during a siege, there's what are called tantrum spirals, which is where a dwarf gets upset, so he has a tantrum, and then eventually his tantrum is so crazy that he has to be put down. Unfortunately, that dwarf had friends who become upset that their friend was put down and throw tantrums themselves.
You know,
they have to be struck down.
You know what would be awesome for this? A Willy Wonka mod where they're all Oompa Loompas.
Well, they're just ASCII characters, right? So you just imagine them being Oompa Loompas.
Exactly. If you play the very raw one, the game is presented to you in ASCII, but you can install various graphics packs that make it look considerably nicer to play.
There, you just edit the sprite sheet or whatever. Okay, but there has been, as far as I know, there's like a new version of Dwarf Fortress that came out. I don't know how often it gets updated.
The latest version came out actually a few days ago on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Before that, the last release was in May of last year. So it's been nearly a year since the last update.
Is it pretty typical of how often it gets updated?
Usually, I think how it works, it's one guy that does this all by himself, essentially. His name, or he goes by the username Toadie, and I believe how he does it is he'll release it, do a bunch of bug fixes up to a certain point, and then he'll just kind of leave it and just start working on the next iteration. In the previous one was like 99% stable. There were some like weird little things that didn't work. Like this, there's a class of dwarf called a dungeon keeper that's supposed to be able to train exotic animals, and that was broken. So that never got fixed in the previous version, but this new version actually adds quite a bit of stuff like vampires, werewolves, things of that nature.
Does the lazy new pack still work with it, or will I be stuck with the old version?
No, they haven't done a lazy new pack for the new version yet. There's also a really great program called Dwarf Therapist that makes the game a lot more playable because it presents your dwarves and then all the skills that you can have turned on in a big grid and then lets you, you know, click to turn them on. Otherwise, you have to go through this very complicated system of finding the dwarf on the map and then going to his labors page and scrolling to the labors page and enabling the labor that you want him to be able to use. And it's a real big pain in the butt. And some people have gotten Dwarf Therapist working for the new version. If you look on the forums, there's INI files to get it working with the new version, but it's not 100% complete functionally. So that makes it a lot harder to play.
So maybe wait just a little while.
Yeah, I would probably suggest waiting. Also, the wiki has not been updated, and the wiki is really handy to have with you when you're playing.
Or can I still get a hold of the old version if I wanted to?
Yeah.
And just play that
if
one
you
instead.
Just, if you just go to download the Lazy New Pack, I mean, they still have the Lazy New Pack for that particular version. And when you download the Lazy New Pack, you get everything that you could want in one package, which makes it really fantastic if you're just getting started. And if anybody out there is actually interested in getting started, there's a lot of great videos called Let's Plays. I don't know. A lot of people are familiar with the concept of a Let's Play.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of great Let's Plays for Dwarf Fortress. It's a very popular game to do Let's Plays of.
So let me just get this straight. You're watching someone watch The Matrix, and you're supposed to be entertained by this.
No, you're supposed to be educated by
educated.
This. You're learning to have fun.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Well, you have some control, right?
What do you mean?
I think he's talking about the Let's Plays.
Right, but the player
playing
has
Dwarf Fortress. Yeah, you have some kind of like you can influence things.
You have
it's
input.
Not like you're just watching these guys go cats everywhere. Oh God! No, it's not like that.
Okay, so it's not like that Game of Life where you set up a board and then you just watch
it's
process.
Not really like that.
Okay. So basically this is an abstract, and you could put graphics on it if you want. Is what
you're
saying?
Well, yeah.
I'm kind of developing this theory in my head about getting into game design for a second. The original Atari games were very blocky. Like, sometimes you were an actual block on the screen.
Yeah.
And the current games, new players, they won't understand why game behavior works a certain way. Like, I saw somebody playing Assassin's Creed, and their player would suddenly just jump off a building when they were wanting him to climb up. And they said, "No, you're so stupid. Why do you do this?" And I think it's probably more player error than game error. But to explain it, it's kind of hard. If you were to take away all the fancy graphics and make everything a block, either in just different colored blocks, and then you've got the buildings and the street and the people, then you would be able to see, and then there would be attachable surfaces that you would be able to climb up, and they would be another color. You would be able to see the game more as the engine sees it, rather than how you're seeing it as a as an artificial world.
And that's kind of how Dwarf Fortress is, and it's almost a matter of, I just had this, and now I've completely lost what I was going to say.
Well, Wolverine said kind of reminded me of Mirror's Edge. I don't know if you ever played that. All of the things that you can interact with are just like big, bright, red whatevers. And so
basically everything in the entire game is color-coded as to what you can do with it. Yeah. And your goal is always in red.
And everybody has always like said how amazing Mirror's Edge controls are for what for being like an FPS platformer or whatever.
I mean, I've only played maybe the first quarter of the game because I was borrowing it from a friend. But I was compelled. Like, I didn't want to give it back to him, but I had to. And I was like, this game is... I don't know why people hated on this game so much. I mean...
It was really short.
The general criticism was the length of it was really, really short. But I really liked the game.
So you could theoretically... If you had the ability to, if it was on computer, you could skin these abstract objects and make them look like a sword or something, probably.
In Dwarf Fortress?
No, in Mirror's Edge.
Have you never played Mirror's Edge?
No.
Do you not know what Mirror's Edge is?
No, I don't.
It's
parkour, the game, basically.
Yeah. Okay.
Essentially, you play a character who's a bag runner, and you're running through across a utopia world that's really bland and bleak, and there's like absolutely no color anywhere, so everything's white and glass and shiny and everything.
Okay.
So as you're moving the character across buildings or sewers or whatever, or across rooftops, you're trying to make the fastest path through the world and avoid guards who have guns and shoot you and stuff like that. So when you're playing through the story, there's, you know, story, and I think the way they presented it was like short little like comic strip looking things, and then you play through the game and you get all this weird story, and then at the end of it, they enable a time trial for all the levels. So then, like at the end of the game, it becomes trying to compete with people to find the fastest path through the game.
Okay.
I think.
But there's not a lot of fancy graphics.
No, the graphics they're about par, average for the course or whatever. But the minimalistic approach to displaying the game is actually really good. Like it's definitely worth watching someone play it on YouTube to get the concept and the look for this game, because it was really mind-boggling when people first saw it.
I think if you removed the fancy graphics from all the current games, what you would be left with is the gameplay. And that's... I don't know. I think you could skin... If you got the engine for old Atari games and you reskin them somehow, you would be able to...
Breathe new life into them?
Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know.
Kind of like the Monkey Island.
Yeah, like it's the same engine exactly. Yeah. It's just different graphics.
Yeah,
I don't know what my thesis there is, but I guess it is that they're within a game, the contents of the game. There's this, the physics, which are what you're actually interacting with, and that even in a non-action game, and then there's the everything else is just skin. Yeah. It's just a coating on that stuff.
I think the thing is about Dwarf Fortress that makes it really popular is it's very much a what happens if I do this type of game. Like you learn kind of like the basic rules of how to play, but then as far as that, you can do whatever you want. You don't have to dig underground if you don't want to, or you can try to like survive without cutting down any trees, or try to live like make your dwarves live like elves and build all their structures out of wood or whatever. And I think that's kind of the core exciting thing is, and they've had to keep the graphics very simple and kind of, you know, the blocky ASCII to try and make it so that you can have as many options as you possibly can in the actual gameplay. Because, I mean, I always feel like it's definitely a big trade-off. You have to, whenever you're designing a game, you have to make a decision, like, at the beginning, how much do I want to be able to let the player do whatever they want versus how I want it to look good, because of the limitations of what a computer is capable of presenting to you.
I don't know. I once, in one of my early IST classes, it was actually the first HCI class, I had to present a paper, and I chose a thesis paper by, I think it's Jorgis Magnusson, one of the guys who works in DICE, the big Battlefield producers who work for EA. And the paper was on how much UI that you give to gamers. And like I showed a couple different ways of presenting information. And like the paper actually talks about Mirror's Edge, and it also talks about Left 4 Dead. Like whenever you see something in Left 4 Dead, it's like it has that little halo glow around it.
Yeah, halo.
And like when your teammates are in trouble, even if they're behind a wall, you see the orange glow around them, letting you know where they are. And the thing about Mirror's Edge is that everything that you can interact with is in red. If you can go through this door, it's in red. If it's not, it just looks like a gray or white door.
Mm-hmm.
And what really interests me about human-computer interaction and usability and UI is getting those key ideas of how much do we put in a HUD, how much do we show in-game, and I can't remember the actual term for it, is how do we present things in the world that the player knows instinctually that they can use it?
Yeah, yeah.
Or do we have to have a little pop-up that says press X to hold up?
Yeah.
Or to pick up?
Right. I think that the trend towards the pop-up button, it kind of detracts from gameplay.
Yeah.
Since about 2000, that's just been...
I would really like...
Don't like it either?
Don't even talk to me about Nintendo nowadays. Oh, my God. This is the most hand-holding crap. I used to be... I was totally okay with that. I mean, she was obnoxious, yes, but she was, like, optional.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, like, I can't even play Nintendo games. I was the biggest Nintendo fanboy for the longest time. I had nothing but Nintendos up until, like, the 360 PS3 generation.
Yeah.
And then, like, my Wii has just been practically useless because anything that I play, it's just like, God, I can't.
It's
stand
like
telling me everything about this game. Just let me like discover something
it's
on
like,
my own.
It's like playing a game of Simon. It's like the button lights up that you need to press next.
Yeah, yeah. It's preposterous. It's like it's why I'm it's why I don't even play console games hardly anymore. It's because I'll go play these little indie games on the PC that don't tell me at all. I just go and I can just go and like you open Terraria up. You know what it tells you? Nothing. You just give you like a pickaxe and maybe like a wooden sword or something. And they plop you down in this world, and it's got typical WASD controls. So you just start moving around and hopping, and like you just kind of hope to figure it out because there is no instructions.
That's what you did back in the day the NES
days.
And it's
way more fun that way. Yeah.
And I find it weird because what they call now contextual controls, where a button will do something different depending on whether you're standing facing a door or whether you're standing facing an enemy.
Contextual controls are the bane of my existence.
Well, the thing is, they've always existed. Way back, since probably maybe before NES, but definitely
not
at least NES days.
Yeah.
And they were never, you just had to know that you were in that context where this button would do this.
Yeah.
And you maybe had to reference the instruction book for a while until you got the hang of it, but the player was just assumed to have enough capability to understand this concept, and somewhere along the line it got to where designers thought we need to make everything as clear as possible, but it got to a point where it's hand-holding now.
Think it's all just trying to appeal. With Nintendo, I remember they had this big shift with the Wii where they were like, we were going to appeal to a mainstream audience. And like that, we just want to. Basically, they're trying to get as many customers as they possibly can. Which I mean, they're a business. Okay, I can respect that.
You should redefine mainstream to casual gamer.
Well, whatever you want to call it.
No, I'm just saying that, like, to everyone listening who understands gaming, when he says mainstream, he means casual. That means soccer moms, 15-year-old girls,
people who
grandma.
Buy the Wii Fit board.
Yeah.
Well, the
screw you, 'cause I have one.
Mainstream society.
Yeah. He's not
hardcore gamers.
They're trying to, for people who don't play games. And so,
I hate the phrase hardcore gamers, by the way.
I don't hate the term hardcore gamer. I just hate the negative connotation that people put on it. I'm a hardcore gamer. I play games.
I didn't know there was a negative connotation.
12 hours of the day. The negative connotation in hardcore gamer is that you spend way too much time, and you're obnoxious about your proficiency in playing games,
so
or your skill level.
So when you're a dweeb.
The thing is I don't think I'm elitist. I play games because I love to play games. Right. I'd love to sit here and talk about it and debate. Yeah. But when you get to the point, like the most popular usage of hardcore is talking about MMOs. So the guys who are there, they're on the public test realms. You know, they're theory crafting, they're crunching numbers, and they're min maxing. When they get up in arms and they're like, "Oh, you need to change the game right now, or we'll quit playing." That's the negative connotations that everyone thinks hardcore gamers are jerks, and that gamers demand.
So what do we call
vocal
them?
Minority? That's what that is.
What should we call ourselves then? Avid gamers.
We are avid gamers.
Okay. So
in this room.
Nintendo is appealing to a mainstream casual game audience with the Wii.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, derailed you.
I'm sorry, I don't even know where I was going exactly with that, except for, well, I mean, I think that's where all of this hand-holding came from, is because your grandma or whoever sits down and tries to play games, they don't care to take the effort and the time to, like, figure out what's going on.
My grandmother plays Super Mario Brothers, and she can get to World 8 consistently.
Yeah. With or without warp pipes.
this is, and that's another thing. It's like just bad game design. The whole like hand holding is
because
you know, like you need to build your game. Like your tutorial should not just be like a bunch of words telling people how to do things. The game should like teach you play by having you play the game.
Yeah,
yeah. I think a good way to do that. Is let's look at this new Super Mario Brothers. When you fail so many times, Luigi pops up and say, "Hey, if you ask me to come help, I'll show you how to do this level," and he'll play through the level. I think
that never happened to me. I wouldn't know.
Listen, I watch. I don't watch. I read Penny
Arcade. Hardcore gamer.
It's the way Nintendo handles early or not proficient gamers. It's kind of sad.
Okay, if they did that with all of their games, that would be great. But
they really do. They kind of start doing that. Like,
have you played Skyward Sword? There is a function in the game where if you go back to the main like island place in the middle, there's a talking stone, and if you talk to it, it can show you how to do any puzzle in the entire game.
Yeah.
Like up to the point where you are and the next following puzzle.
But it doesn't flash in your face while you're there at the puzzle?
No, like I didn't know it was there until I was like at the final boss and I was just like joking around. I went back to the main like island just to like check everything out before I went and beat the game. And then I was like, "Hey, what's this? Oh, that's what they were talking about." And it literally just shows you how to do every single puzzle in the entire game. It mentions it once and it's like, "Hey, if you need some help, there's some guy over there that can help you out," but it doesn't necessarily throw it in your face the whole time. And, I don't know, Skyward Sword, I'm a big fan of that game, but whatever.
I think with the first Zelda 64 game is where it started for Nintendo. Because you... when you would approach a ladder, was it A or B button would flip over and say, "Climb!"
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's more contextual. Like,
But
that's better than like having some guy tell you, like, when you walk up to the ladder, somebody's like, "Hey, make sure that you go to that ladder and climb it."
Yeah, but it opened the door for them to do that sort of thing.
Like when you play Fable or some other action adventure games, you get that little cookie crumb sprite dust on the floor telling you exactly where to go.
Yeah,
those kind of things annoy me.
Yeah. There's no exploration
in Dead Space,
anymore.
Right?
I think they did that in Dead Space, but it's something you have to pull out and use it. I would prefer the ability to turn these things on and off. Like when you start the game up, if it's like a difficulty setting, like I want to be on the highest difficulty level, turn off all the aids. I want to experience the game, turn them all off.
Yeah, it would make a whole different game.
A design shift towards that.
Yeah. I think that would be a huge boon to a lot of these games if they just let you opt out of all of these hand-holding maneuvers.
And that reminds me of the design choice that they're doing for Mass Effect 3, the multiple settings where you can tweak. Do you want to just watch the story? We'll turn down the combat for you. We'll turn the AI up and your damage up, so you have to you can focus less on combat, or do you want to be or have you played Mass Effect since the beginning and you know what you're doing and you want that challenge? We'll tweak everything up, turn down your damage, turn the enemy damage up, and turn the experience down a little bit. That it's a lot of people are all up in arms about it, but when you think about it, that's a really good concept. That you let the player, like, everyone wants, the whole goal of all of us in this room when we sit down and play a game is experience it, enjoy it, but we're all going to enjoy it differently. We all learn things differently. All, you know, that right. Kind of. So
there's no more individual experience anymore.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's a hard thing to do is, right. Is create group experiences. Like when my girlfriend and I play MMOs, we always try to.